My name is Joel. I'm one of the teaching pastors at Mosaic, and I am glad to be here with you guys. As you may have heard a little bit about this already, this is the last Sunday night that we have here at Summerport, and it has been just a ton of fun to be able to be here, to be able to worship here, to allow the community that is Mosaic at Walt Disney World to happen here. So it's really been a joy to be able to be a part of that. As I said, my name is Joel, and I am one of the teaching pastors at the church that planted this campus, and it's called Mosaic, and it meets in Oakland. So, man, I'm just excited to be here tonight. Brady, the campus pastor here, he is struggling with life right now, suffering for the Lord on the Disney fantasy. So, and here we are. And you're stuck listening to me for the next 34 minutes, so, man, but I really am glad to be here with you guys. Where we've been over the last few weeks, we've been traveling through kind of the last few days of Jesus' life on this earth as a human. You know, Jesus came to this earth fully God, fully man, lived a perfect, sinless life, and the last few days of his life were rough, and we've been kind of traveling through those. Last week, we had an incredible opportunity to celebrate all the things that God has been doing, or maybe some of the things God has been doing, maybe not all, but some of the things that God has been doing in people's lives over the last few months here at Mosaic. And so we got to see people step into baptism and just saying, hey, I follow Jesus. And so it was a really, really special week last week. But the week before, where we left off kind of at the trial of Jesus. There was, before Jesus was crucified, they brought him in for a trial before the religious leaders of the Jewish people. And it really was kind of a joke of a trial. It was a little bit of a mock trial. And ultimately, what Jesus was arrested for and ultimately crucified for, from a human perspective, Jesus was actually crucified for blasphemy. And blasphemy is simply a man claiming to be God. That's really what blasphemy is. A lot of people kind of think kind of bring forth this idea that Jesus never claimed to be God. Because there's no verse in the Bible that you can look at and Jesus said, I am God. There is no, so that is true. Jesus did not use those three words altogether, but over and 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 over, time and time again, throughout Jesus' ministry, and especially in the last few days of his life, he kept claiming to be God, which made the religious leaders of the day very, very angry. Of course, Jesus also had an incredible following, and so he was gaining a lot of popularity and influence in the culture. And as we look throughout history, when religious people begin to lose their influence, they go to great lengths to keep their influence. And so from a human perspective, Jesus was gaining all this attention and garnering all of these followers. And as a result, because he did continually claim to be God, the Jewish leaders decided to crucify him. So that's kind of where we left off in Jesus' story. And as we jump in tonight, we're going to talk about the crucifixion, what happened to Jesus the last day of his life. But before we do that, we're going to jump just a little bit further back in his story to the Garden of Gethsemane. It was right before Jesus had been arrested, just before Judas betrayed him. And Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he was spending his last few uninterrupted moments with his Father, with God. And the Bible records that he was praying and spending time with God, and the disciples were kind of with him, but they were a little sleepy, so they struggled. But Jesus was spending his last few free moments on this earth before his trial, before his arrest, before his crucifixion with his Father. So we're going to go to page 573 of the Mosaic Blue Bibles that are under your chairs, or to Luke chapter 22 if you brought your own Bible. Hey, if you don't have a good Bible at home, these are purposefully for you. We want you to take it. We want you to write your name in it. There's a really cool reading plan in the beginning. I'm a big fan of it. So we want you to take it, write your name in it, keep it. Maybe if you have a friend who needs a Bible, give it away. We don't care. We can always get more. Luke chapter 22 or page 573 of the Mosaic Bibles. Again, Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he's in verse 39, we pick up his conversation with God. It says, "And he came out and went, as was his custom, to the Mount of Olives, and the disciples followed him. And when he came to the place, he said to them, 'Pray that you may not enter temptation.' And he withdrew from them about a stone's throw away, knelt down, and prayed." If you've seen The Passion of the Christ, I think Mel Gibson does an incredible job of capturing this moment. Jesus is, he's not dumb. He knows what's coming. In fact, this was the mission that God sent him to fulfill on this earth. And so he knows in the last few moments of freedom that he has, this conversation with his father, it's an intense and very difficult conversation. I think that it must have been incredibly full of anxiety. I don't know about you guys, but I got spanked a lot when I was a kid. A lot. My dad passed away when I was really young, so I've been spanked by more human beings. Like, my mom farmed that job out to like any random dude that would accept it. It was awesome. And so I've been spanked by more humans than like my hands and toes. I can't count. Like, there's so many. It's good for me, though. I still need them from time to time. But one time, I had done wrong things, as usual, and I was about to get a spanking. And at the time, my family was living with another family, and the father of the house kind of assumed the responsibility of disciplining me in that way, which was excellent because he was huge. And it was frightening, and he had this paddle that his dogs, he had boxers, and these dogs like chewed up this paddle. So it was like this splinter-filled filled paddle. It was pretty rough. You guys are like, this kid was abused. Does anyone know that? Someone should tell him he was abused. I know. So I was not a fan of this paddle, and I knew I was about to encounter it yet again. And so I decided I'm going to outsmart this Mike guy. And I hid the paddle very well, actually. And so, of course, I'm about to get spanked, and there's the ritual that comes with that. At least he didn't, make me go pick out the switch or something. I had friends that their dads did that. I'm like, that's horrible. So anyway, I just had a splintered paddle. And I hid it, and he starts looking for it. He's like, "Joel, you better tell me where that paddle is. I don't know what you're talking about. You know where the paddle is, Joel, and it's better for you if you find it." I don't know what you're talking about. I was just playing outside like I normally do. I have no idea. Well, Mike was handy, unlike me, and went out to the backyard and began. I hear the saw kick in. He begins to fashion a new paddle in his work shed, and I'm in the house. And that feeling of like, oh, your stomach is kind of like that constant, I'm on the Tower of Terror, but I can't get off feeling, And so I'm like, oh, I know this is going to be bad. And so I decide, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? I have an idea. I'll lock him out. So I go lock the door. I'm like, pa ha, I outsmarted him again. But then I got to thinking about it. I played out the full scenario in my mind. And I thought to myself, self, he's eventually going to get into the house. He already knows you hid the paddle. He can't prove it, but he knows it. And he's fashioning what's probably some sort of monstrosity of a paddle to hit me with. And the more I make him wait, the harder it's going to be and the worse it's going to be. So I wised up, I unlocked the door, and just got a regular spanking, which was awesome. Later on in life, I told him where I hid that paddle. He's like, oh, it's probably still there. Oh, man. But, that must have really been for Jesus. Kind of, that feeling, but like times a billion and totally different. But it must have felt similar for Jesus, as he's getting ready to approach completing the mission that God had really sent him to the earth to complete. And so he has this conversation with his father. He says, "Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. In verse 44, it says, and being in great agony, he prayed more earnestly and his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. He makes a statement to the Father. He said, Father, remove this cup from me. What was the cup that Jesus was talking about? The cup Jesus was talking about there is literally, it is the cup of the wrath of God that was about to be poured out on him, on the cross, on our behalf. You know, for us, I think in kind of an American like voting culture where we have like a pretty light justice system, it's very difficult for us to really think about wrath like this. The kind of wrath that a man who had walked around for 3 years casting out demons, healing the sick, opening up blind eyes, opening up deaf ears, raising the dead, a man like that was terrified of the wrath of God. And for us, because we don't really know what pure and holy wrath looks like, when we think about the wrath of God, a lot of times it's a little bit frightening. Because I don't know about you, but for me, when I think about like this being, this huge God, crazy big being pouring out wrath, it conjures up images of, you know, Jafar genie, right? And he's like, I've got all the power in the world. What does he say? The most powerful genie in the world. Is that right? Yeah. I sometimes mess up on my Disney line, so I need some help from you guys. But that's really kind of the picture that we get. We get this villainous picture of this monstrous being that's ready to just pour out all of his anger. And the reality is, in some ways, that's a decent picture, but in other ways, it's not, because here's the thing. God, unlike Disney villains, God, unlike any other person that we might experience that might pour out wrath, God is a perfect and a holy and a just God. You know, we do enjoy justice to a certain extent. Justice is a good thing. Justice is helpful. When we've been wronged, justice is helpful. When someone has done something against us, justice is helpful. When the penalty for someone's transgression against us prevents them from doing it, justice is helpful. And so there are times where justice is good. We all kind of have a sense for justice, right? Like, how many of you guys remember, if you had brothers and sisters, this was a word that came out a lot in my house and probably came out in your house. When something would happen, you would appeal to mom and dad and say, that's not fair, right? We have a sense of justice that's kind of built into the core and the nature of who we are. And in fact, we kind of like it. It actually makes us feel safe. Except when it's being exacted upon us for the things that we've done. My mom, once in a while, she was smarter than me. And I shouldn't have really even said that in the past tense. My mom is smarter than me and always will be. And when I was a kid, from time to time, I would do something wrong and I would get in trouble. And once in a while, I'm talking like once every blue moon, I actually didn't do the thing that I was in trouble for, right? And so I was innocent at that moment. Mom, I promise you, I didn't do it. It was that person or just the circumstances. I promise you, it wasn't me. My mom would always say, Joel, is there anything that you did that deserved this punishment that I may have missed? Yes, you know? And so, but there's something in us deep to our core that understands justice. And in fact, we long for it. We desire it because it's right. And so Jesus, in that moment in the Garden of Gethsemane, is feeling the emotional weight, the reality that he was about to walk in to the full wrath of a just and holy God. In the Old Testament, before Jesus died and resurrected from the dead, they had a system set up where when the people would sin, once a year, someone would come in and perform a sacrifice to appease or to atone for the sin of the Israelite community. And this high priest, he would go through rituals. I mean, really rigorous rituals, washings and prayers of repentance and sacrifices and burnt offerings and all of these different things before he would approach God to ask for the sins of the people to be forgiven. And God is so holy, he's so righteous, he's so just that sin cannot exist in his tangible presence. There is no fellowship between God and sin. And so the people would approach God and through the high priest. And if the high priest had any blemish, he had missed any of the ceremonial washings, if he had any sin in his heart in that moment as he approached God for the people, he would fall down dead. They would actually tie a rope and a bell, a cowbell around his ankle. I need more cowbell. They would tie a cowbell and a rope as he would walk in, just in case he had forgotten something, just in case he had sin in his life. And if he died, they would know because the cowbell would stop ringing, and then they would be able to use the rope that was tied around his leg to drag out his body, because if he had died, they couldn't go in after him because they would die too. See, God is a holy, righteous, perfect God. And he created us to be in fellowship with him. But because we rebelled, it put a chasm between our relationship, because there's a holy, just, perfect, righteous God. And here we are as sinful humanity. And so God set up this system with the high priest so that we could walk into the presence of God, still have relationship with God, yet God would never have to compromise his holiness and his justice and his perfection. And the Bible tells us that Jesus was our ultimate and final high priest. And that what we're about to read, what we're about to step into, what Jesus experienced for us on the cross, Jesus paved the way for us to be able to have access to God, to a holy, righteous, and perfect God. Not because we're good enough, but because he was good enough. You can flip the page over to 574, still in the book of Luke. We're going to step into Luke's account of the crucifixion of Jesus. Luke chapter 23, verse 26. Jesus has just been arrested and charged and convicted of being a blasphemer. And as they led him away, they seized Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, and laid on him the cross to carry it behind Jesus. And there followed him a great multitude of people and of women who were mourning and lamenting for him. But turning to them, Jesus said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the days are coming when they will say, 'Blessed are the barren in the wombs, never born, the breasts that never nursed.' Then they will begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and the hills, 'Cover us.' For if they do these things when the wood is green, what will happen when it is dry?" Jesus is prophesying over the people, saying, "If you reject me now, you're going to reject me in the future." Verse 32, "Two others who were criminals were led away to be put to death with him. And when they came with him, and when they came to the place that is called the Skull, there they crucified him. And the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. And Jesus said, 'Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do.' And they cast lots to divide his garments, and the people stood by watching. But the ruler scoffed at him, saying, 'He saved others. Let him save himself, if he is the Christ of God, his chosen one.' The soldiers also mocked him, coming up and offering him sour wine and saying, if you are the king of the Jews, save yourself. There was also an inscription over him, this is the king of the Jews. One of the criminals who were hanged railed at him saying, are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us. But the other rebuked him saying, do you not fear God? Since you were under the same sentence of condemnation, and indeed, we justly, for we are receiving the due reward for our deeds. But this man, he has done no wrong. And he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And he said to him, truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. It was now about the sixth hour. And there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour, in which the sun's light failed. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Then Jesus, calling out with a loud voice, said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Having said that, he breathed his last. Now, when the centurion saw what had taken place, he praised God, saying, certainly, this man was innocent. Other translations say, certainly this man was the Son of God. In another gospel, as Jesus is hanging on the cross, he utters these words. He says, my God, why have you forsaken me? See, it's tough for us to think about what Jesus went through on that day. I think the Passion of the Christ, again, does a great job helping us kind of get a grasp for what Jesus went through physically on that day. But the truth of the matter is the physical realities of the crucifixion barely even touched the surface of the agony of what Jesus went through. Because the reality is Jesus didn't simply go to the cross and die a criminal's death. He went to the cross to bear the weight of our sin. The criminal that was on the cross said, you know what? We are here justly for the deeds that we have done, but this man has done no wrong. Jesus was on that cross because of your and my sin. Isaiah 53, written hundreds of years before Jesus came to the earth. It's on page 396 of the Mosaic Bibles. The prophet Isaiah is foretelling what Jesus would go through. And the crucifixion account details what Jesus experienced. But in Isaiah 53, this is what is said about Jesus. Who has believed what he has heard from us, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he, this is Jesus, grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of the dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. This is Jesus. He was despised and rejected by men. A man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement, that is severe punishment, that brought us peace. And by his wounds, we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him, on Jesus, the iniquity, the sin of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that is before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off from the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people. And they made his grave with the wicked and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. Guys, listen to this. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous. And he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will divide him a portion with the many, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors, yet he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressors. You know, Isaiah 53 describes to us the anguish, the sorrow, the grief, and humanity's response to what Jesus was doing for us. We wouldn't even look at him. And yet he took upon himself our sin on the cross. And not only did Jesus take our sin upon himself on the cross, but he took the wrath of God that our sin deserved upon himself on the cross. See, you and I, we've all rebelled. All of us. Every single one here. I could share story after story after story of how I've rebelled in many different ways, and I'm sure we could spend a lot of time on that subject together. Were we honest with one another? We've all sinned. Romans chapter 3 says that we've all sinned and we've fallen short of the glory of God. And Jesus stepped onto this planet to pay the penalty for our sin, to become one with our sin, and to experience the wrath of God and allow the wrath of God to be poured out on him. And here's the beauty of it. So that you and so that I would not have to bear the wrath of God for our sin and for our rebellion. There's a guy named Paul, and he writes to the Romans who actually crucified Jesus. He writes to the Romans in the book of Romans on page 611. And Paul, he was a devout Jew. He was among those Jews who thought Jesus to be a blasphemer. And Paul was on the side of those that crucified Jesus. And yet Jesus stopped him in his tracks one day, revealed himself to Paul and said, "Paul, stop persecuting me. I am who I said I am. Follow me." And so Paul, who was persecuting those who were following Jesus, killing them, putting them in prison, his life was turned around 100% when he encountered Jesus. And this is what Paul says about who Jesus is and what it is that he accomplished for us on the cross. It's in Romans chapter 3, starting in verse 21. He says this. He says, "But now the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law, although the law and the prophets bear witness to it." This is what he's saying. Okay, back in the day, in order to be righteous with God, there had to be a high priest. There had to be a sacrifice made for sin. And that was part of becoming right with God. And he said, that used to be the case, but now there is a new righteousness that is apart from the law. It's separate from the law. And yet the law and the prophets, like Isaiah that we just read, the law and the prophets, they testified about this righteousness that is now revealed. It says, the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. For there is no distinction, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation. Well, there's a word we use every day. A propitiation by his blood. Propitiation is this. It is simply that someone has paid the consequence for their transgression, for their wrongdoing. That they've paid that consequence, and now that the person that they sinned against, they are back in right relationship with that person. So if I steal $5 from you, I pay you back $5, and then we become buddies again. That's the idea of propitiation. But the reality is that our sin against a righteous and holy God put us in a debt that we could never repay. And so Jesus came to the earth, took the full weight of our sin, bore the wrath of God so that we could be right with God again. And that's what Paul is talking about when he says that fun word, propitiation. All right, so whom God put forward is a propitiation, a payment back into right relationship by his blood to be received by faith. This was to show God's righteousness. Because in his divine forbearance, he had passed over former sins. It was to show his righteousness at the present time so that he might be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. So what Paul is saying here is, look, Jesus is now our righteousness. We stand right before God because Jesus literally became one with our sin. And God the Father poured out his wrath on our sin, the wrath that our sin deserved, the justice that our sin deserved. Instead of God pouring it out on me, and I deserved it, instead of God pouring it out on you, we all have sinned and fallen short of his glory, but instead of pouring out his wrath on us, he poured it out on Jesus. And so, God is now both 100% just, and he's also the justifier of those who believe. See, if God had simply just forgiven our sin, because he's benevolent, and he's loving, and he's good. If God had simply just forgiven our sin, and there was no payment made for the sin that we committed, it would scream out within even us, within even our simple human minds, we would say, that's not right. There has to be payment for wrongdoing. It's not fair to just simply pass over when people do wrong things. I mean, imagine a society where the wrong things that people did were simply just forgiven. I murder your mother, no big deal, it's cool. We're a benevolent, loving society, so we're gonna love Joel and be nice to him even though he murdered your mother. I'm sure your mother's great. I would never murder your mother. But if I did, you'd be crying out for justice, and rightly so. And the reality is that when God looks at our sin, he doesn't look at it as just something to be swept under the rug, something that's no big deal. But you know what? Instead of holding you and me to it, instead of pinning us to the wall with the sin that we committed with our own rebellion, God pinned Jesus to the cross. And Jesus chose to walk up that hill, cross on his shoulder, to get up on that cross and die a horrible death, experiencing the full weight of the wrath of God, so you wouldn't have to, and so I wouldn't have to. You guys, this is why we call the gospel good news. It's good news. You guys, this is good news. We kind of breezed by it really quick, but in Luke, verse 45 of chapter 28, it says that when Jesus died, that the veil in the temple was ripped from top to bottom. The veil that Luke is talking about is the veil that kept the presence of God in and people out. And when Jesus died on the cross, taking the full weight and wrath for our sin, there was no longer a barrier between God and man because Jesus took it away. And so God became both just and justifier through faith in Jesus. Not an ounce of his holiness has been removed, not an ounce of his justice, not an ounce of his goodness, because he poured out his wrath on the sin that we committed on Jesus on the cross. And if we put our faith in him, the veil is torn, propitiation has been made, we are back in right relationship with the God who created us, who loves us, and who desires to be with us forever. Let's pray. Jesus, thank you so much that in the Garden of Gethsemane, even though you knew how horrific it would be to bear the wrath of the Father that our sin so justly deserves. Thank you that though there is no doubt in my mind, everything in your being screamed out, "Let this cup pass." I thank you that you decided that the will of the Father, that our redemption, that our rescue was worth the cost. Jesus, thank you for that. You're so, so good. And Jesus, my only response to you in light of all this is thank you. Thank you, Jesus. What you did for me, what you did for everyone in this room, what you did for all who you would redeem, thank you. Thank you for that. And what you did deserves my life. So I give it to you. I give it to you because you deserve it. Thank you so much for what you did for me. And thank you, God, that now I can approach you with confidence, knowing that Jesus has paved the way. The veil is torn from top to bottom. God, it was the work that you did from heaven to earth. God, you did the work. And God, thank you that we get to receive the blessing that comes from that. We love you, Jesus. We respond in worship to you now.